a real deal. I'll shoot your liver out and hand it to you.
Welcome back to another episode of the Cue It Up podcast. Today, I'm going to be joined with a world pool master, a matchroom commentator, and now the European Moscone Cup captain, Alex Lely. How are you doing?
All good. Nice to be on the show, on your podcast. And yeah, all good. Still buzzing a bit from the one pocket matchup between Chohan and Filler that we commentated together. That was really cool. Like, something different. The quickest one pocket I've ever witnessed.
It was wild. I ended up watching it back actually twice now. I watched it back the day after, and then I watched it back again just a day ago, and I still don't know what I witnessed. I've never seen one pocket like that. It was great.
Yeah, it was good. I'm watching it back a bit more thorough, like I'm making an analysis, and But it was interesting. But they'll be playing again at some point soon.
Yeah,
we'll see more of Filler in the one pocket. That's for sure.
I am looking forward to it because that is some of the most exciting one pocket I've ever seen. It was great, and it was a pleasure. It was an absolute pleasure to get to sit in with you and commentate for that. So I thank you for letting me jump in with you.
Oh, good.
So I'm bringing you on today for not only obviously the biggest pool event in the entire universe is the Moscone Cup, so we will absolutely get to that. But I don't want to brush over the actual storied career that you have, because you don't just become a Moscone Cup captain for no reason, of course. You have a lot of rich history in the game of pool that really warrants your picking for that role. So I would like to definitely highlight that and chat about that. So the first question I will have for that is, where did it all begin? How did you get into pool? And, basically, take me through the early life of Alex to where you got into being a top professional player.
This was when I was about 16. I started frequenting the typical Dutch bars and where they sell the Dutch culture, and they have pool tables. So at the time, we didn't have any pool halls, but all the bars, many bars, shops, coffee shops, they had a pool table. And then you put down a guilder, and it's winner stand, so you challenge the winner, and that's how I started. And then when a couple of years later they opened this big club in The Hague, Hague 5, that's when it really kicked off. So I was playing rugby at the time when I played in the bars, and the opening of the pool club, Hague 5, was in the time that I got injured heavily, so I quit my rugby. And then I got really hooked in the game. And Johan Ruysink was there at the time, and the current owner of Hague 5 was involved. Niels Feijen was there when I was 20. Niels was there, he was 16. So there was a lot of passion for the game and a lot of hunger to find knowledge. We all know Johan Ruysink, and he's always been very cerebral, analytical about the game. And so was I, and Niels was into it. So, yeah, it didn't start out slowly. As soon as that club opened, it took me 3/4 year to realize that I had no chance of getting my degree in college. And I devoted all my time, everything I had into developing as a player.
That's an incredible pool hall when you have Johan, Niels, and yourself coming out of a single pool room immediately when it opens, basically. There's some history in that place.
Yeah, and I think every player needs to have someone close by who is competitive, sort of on the same level, so they can rub off each other. I've done a lot of coaching all over Europe. I've seen and worked with many young players. And I've seen it where there's like this one talented kid, a 15-year-old, somewhere in the middle of nowhere. But if there's no one around, if it's not a hotspot of players, not a place to grow and develop, then it's going to be very difficult for that kid. So we were lucky to have each other, and you know, all that competition paid off. Yeah.
So by my math, which isn't very good, you are about 4 years older than Niels. When you first started playing with him, who was getting the edge?
In the beginning, it was me. So he had a snooker background, and he was very good at making balls. I was a bit smarter at the table. So first me, and then him, and then me, and then him. And I think after that, I didn't catch up anymore. but this was, you know, it's in spurs of a year, year and a half, maybe 2 years, where one is the upper hand, and then the other guy's working hard to catch up.
Yeah, and you constantly are pushing each other to get better. Yeah, I mean, that's what you need if you want to become a top player. That's pretty pretty cool to have.
And that. It wasn't not always in good fun or in good spirit. You know, it's if I speak for myself, it's difficult to not be too much ego involved. So when you're losing, it's not fun. It's difficult to separate the game from the person. And and especially at that time, we developed in different ways. So I wasn't so much the someone who trained and practiced, where Niels was already doing many drills and exercises, very devoted. And I was more of an all-round player, playing three cushion and snooker and eight ball left pocket, just, you know, different approach. Yeah, and then later, well, the luck that we have in the Netherlands is that we are a small nation, like geographically. It's maybe 300 kilometers from north to south and 200 from west to east. And that we had a subsidy from the government. We got pretty good money. So at some point, Johan became the head coach. This is maybe 8 years later. And if you have money and a top sport program, it forces the players to work together as colleagues. So you share knowledge and we're close to each other. So Nick Vandenberg, he lived in Amsterdam. He lives in Amsterdam. And he was 50 kilometers away, which is nothing. And Rico Dix, so he was the pioneer in the Netherlands at the time, he lived in Tilburg, which is 100 kilometers. So it was easy for us to get together. We played mini tournaments, like 50 a man, winner take all. A lot of thinking, talking, competing, doing drills together, playing a lot of straight pool. So Nick Vandenberg in the mix, Niels Feijen, Rico Dix, and later on, Hu GC joined in. So I think due to our analytical approach, and the fact that we were competing a lot in all departments, I think with a small pool of players, we've won many titles. Niels clearly the most, but the rest of us, we haven't done too bad. UGC has won the world Timble title, I think, some 12 years back. Yeah. So that's in the Netherlands, and yeah, there was, you know, we made big leaps. We made big leaps from, I think, 2000 till, starting in 2000. Before we were up and coming, and then I won the World Pool Masters in 99. And then Niels in 2001 finished second at the big Tokyo tournament where Efren won. There was like 150,000 first prize. So it really kicked off from there. And first on the European tour and in the European championships, winning titles. And then more and more internationally, like globally.
So out of that game, I mean, just, I don't want to bring it back to the Moscone Cup all the time, but there are a lot of Moscone Cup appearances, a lot of Masters wins, a lot of basically all the Matchroom events. You guys have won a lot. You guys have a huge number on that. For the your guys' little mini tournament.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, yeah. 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 I mean, it's been good. It's been good. It was great. And, you know, the bonding at some point when we started to work together with a coach and with a program and with protocols. And protocols aren't always nice, but for pool players, protocols help. A little bit of structure. So when Johan started working with us and when we started to work together more, that's when it really kicked off. And at the European Championships and Euro Tours, we started winning a lot.
Definitely. So that pool hall that you started out of, is that still around to this day?
Of course. Hake 5 is the sponsor of Niels Vijen. Sometimes you see Ted Lerner with the logo. It's in The Hague, in Dead Center The Hague. It's a great pool club. It's together with IDM in Bucharest. I think it's the nicest club in Europe. And it's the only one pocket and bank pool club we have in Europe. So if you walk in there, you can have 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 guys who will play you one pocket. And they will bet, and it's not like in the States, so it's going to be a cheap game, but they play and they are very appreciative. And I think going back to our cooperation under the Dutch Federation at the time, if I coach or talk about the game, a big difference, I think, between what we did and the Germans to the east of us that we learned it from is that we, you know, in Germany they play a lot of straight pool, for example. We copied that. We started playing a lot of straight pool. But we also played one pocket and bank pool and Honolulu and all different games. So this is a point I always make if I talk to people. If you want to speed up your learning curve, don't focus on missed shots or made shots. Sure, you want to get your technique to function better. But, you know, knowledge is just as important. And if you don't go outside of your comfort zone, if you don't, you know, force yourself to play different games, it's difficult to learn. I mean, that's why I like one pocket now so much, because in one pocket, if I'm in the States for a week, I pick up 6, 7, 8, 9 new shots. Whereas in nine ball, and I watch a lot of nine ball, I watch a lot of competition, I rarely see something new. And if you want to be like an all-round player, if you look at Efren, of course, he has had always great touch and finesse, exceptional finesse, but there's a lot of knowledge behind that. And he played, he at some point in the Philippines, some decades back, when his action dried up totally, he played bowl climb billiards for 6, 7 years. And that's all touch and speed control. So all those little shots that he always makes so well, it's talent, but it's also a lot of time that he played. So, yeah.
Yeah, you're definitely not going to find too many people that question the resume of Efren Reyes. His all-around game is impeccable. It is wild. But So we can take this from there. And, I do want to ask one more question about the pool room. What is the next generation of Dutch players coming up through there now?
In Hague 5, they don't have any youthful players. In the south of Holland, there's a hotspot, so there's a pool room where many young guys play. And they're really good. They're really good. But in Europe, everywhere you look, there are very talented straight shooting junior players. Just like in the States, I think there are now more and more, but in Europe it's crazy. It's absurd, the level, the technical level. But again, it's, you know, the better everyone is technically, the less it will be about technique and making balls. So I used to work for the Federation. I took over after Johan. Some 2 years back I quit. And I decided to not continue. But even through this podcast, I would like to address all those young players in the Netherlands and urge them to play more different games, work on their all-round game, and be a little more competitive towards each other. So what I see a lot is that, for example, at championships, a Euro Tour or European Championship, all those young players, many young players, they, at least that's my impression, they copy the behavior of the champions. So the champions, they won't be in the hole too much. They take time to themselves. They're in the room. They do sports. They walk around with their earphones in. But this is the end product. When Niels had their age, when Niels was 16, 18, 20, 22, he was always hunting and chasing, chasing victims on the table. And if not that, then chasing others in the nightclub. You know, competitive. And that's the thing I miss a little nowadays with the juniors. You know, exercising and drills, that's all good. But there's also the very competitive arena of matching up with a player. There was a young Danish player went to the States a couple of months back. He was there for 2 months, I think. That's what I believe you need to do.
And that's just go. Yeah, that's an interesting concept. Why do you think that that is? And I'll give you my my idea on why. It seems like communication now is so much easier now than it was in the 90s and even the early 2000s, to where all of these young players not only get to play against each other in events, but they also get to talk on social media all the time. And maybe that makes them closer friendship-wise. Maybe it makes it harder to have that kind of killer mentality in the game. But I'm interested. That's kind of just what I think. I'm interested to hear what you think on that.
What the reason could be. Well, one thing I know is that, and this is also proven scientifically, research, etc., that one deciding factor to determine whether a talent will make a breakthrough or not is their level of autonomy. So have they learned to take control over their own career? Have they learned to make defining choices when they were young? And many kids now are used to work with a trainer, someone that sets up the ball, someone that comforts them when they miss, someone that, you know, pushes them a little bit maybe, but less so are they active in finding solutions themselves. And that's very, very big. They don't go out to find knowledge so much anymore. And like my pillars, if I think about the game, it's head, heart, and arm. Being knowledge, heart is your character, your passion, your cojones. And arm is your technique, and a lot of focus is on arm. Your head, you can study the game, you can think about the game, you can talk about the game. You'll feed your knowledge base, but your heart, you'll grow that by competing, by getting out there. I used to box, just go to the boxing gym and do a little sparring. But the first time you go into the ring, you're shit scared. You're worried about getting hit because you don't know what it will feel like getting hit. And that's the same thing in matching up and competing. The more you do it, you better get at it. So I don't think it's just that. I think it's and. And in the Philippines and Asia and China and the USA, there's a different culture and there's more gambling. So it's a perfect setting to get toughened up, to get battle hardened. If you go play Euro Tour, I don't know, you know, it'll cost, I don't know, 800 euros to go there. And the weaker players will play 4 matches, maybe on average. So that's a lot of traveling, a lot of time, and a lot of money for a little pool. And the thing you learn there, it's a test, and you learn to wait and go to your room and get anxious. And then at 1:45, you can start warming up. But if you're young and hungry and you need to make many flying hours, you know, I say spend the money of 2-3 Euro tours and go to the States. So your question, why is it that, why? One of the reasons is that players nowadays, in Europe at least, are less autonomous.
It's a very easy thing to fix for the next generation then too, because it's just a matter of redirecting, I guess, your your resources towards really improving your game, as opposed to kind of like you said, sitting in your hotel room waiting for your match and then playing two or three, maybe four of them, and then back to your home country you go.
That's the thing. Sorry to interrupt you. That's the thing. But also for trainers to become a little bit more of a coach. So a coach and a trainer is a different thing. And trainers in general, I find the same pitfall. They have difficulty not to talk too much, not to give too much information. But the most value will be in the process where the player is facilitated to learn for himself.
I think that's a really good way of looking at it. So you're okay leaving that there then. We can move on to your career. And as we had already hinted, you have won the 1999 World Pool Masters. You've also won a couple of Euro Tours, and you've been a participant in the Moscone Cup four times. Am I right on saying that?
No. Yeah, well, I played twice, and I captained twice.
Yeah, sorry. I should have said partaken in the Moscone Cup four times. So you definitely have a career worth highlighting and talking about as well. Which of your wins in your career do you think was the most influential, or which one do you cherish the most, and which one do you think would say would be maybe your most legacy cementing win?
Well, the thing I'm proud of is that in finals I beat a couple of the greats. So I won one final against Busti, one against Efren, one against Souquet, one against Archer, and one against Ortman. So I'm happy with that. And, well, it's difficult to pick. You know, I'm happy with all of them, but they all happened in such a different context. So in 99, I was a rookie. So I started playing. The pool club opened in 93. And then 6 years later, I won. And that was nice, but I was so green. And then I think the nicer wins are the one that came through more effort. So after 99, after 2000, I hit a bit of crisis, like a year and a half. And then I started restructuring my game. On my setup. So technically, I set myself up in a different way, a different approach, more professional. I did many things. And in 2002, then I had my first big win against Archer in the Emirates. So that was a big one. But that's for me, that's a different Alex than the one in 99. After 2002, it was much more professional. For sure. And then I must say, so when I'm reflecting, so that's a good thing that I work professionally and diligently and with a lot of effort. But every strength is also a weakness. So if I now look back, what I did do at that point is limit my talent in the game. So I became a very hard worker, sort of neglected my the ease with which I can play. So what you do a lot, you become good at. This is something I learned later when I started coaching, that you can train anything you want. So what I did with my players, also with Niels and Teutcher, not with Bijsterbos because he already plays so quick, is have him work with the shot clock. And then automatically, after a couple of sessions, their game will pick up a bit of speed. So everything is trainable. And in hindsight, I think I became a bit too rigid as a player. But I'm happy with what I did in the game and can still do, who knows, in the future. If I can travel a bit more to the States and play some one pocket, I would like to get a couple of big scalps.
Yeah, there's lots of one pocket action going on in the U.S. right now, which is fantastic. The game it's such a beautiful game, and a lot of people think that it's boring. I think those are the people who don't understand the nuances of the game. and how much thought actually goes into it. Because I think watching chess is kind of boring, but I also know nothing about chess either. So, I mean, those are probably connected in some ways.
Yeah.
So one thing I would like to discuss as well, because I don't think that this – and this is a very, I think, appropriate time for this type of question, because with the shutdown, we are really seeing a lot of the streaming companies and individuals really stepping up and creating a lot of content. And it really puts a larger emphasis on the actual commentating that happens during these events, if they happen, of course. Not all of streams do, but I think the newfound importance of the commentating is it's a very appropriate question at this time, because you, and for my money, you and Jeremy Jones, I could listen to you two talk about pool for the rest of time. I mean, you guys are just, I think you're the most intelligent, you're the most easily relatable, and you guys just know the games at such a high level. I feel like I would be remiss to not chat a little bit about your commentating over the last few years with Matchroom events and other events like you did with Roy. Do you like the commentary thing? Basically, I guess the question is talk a little about your commentating career and basically, you know, what it meant to the legacy of Alex Lalie.
Well, you know, what it means for my legacy, that's for others to decide, I think. But I'm just very happy to be in this position because I'm a maniac about Q Sports. I love all games. I commentate on all games, and every time, most of the times that I sit down, but especially like Matchroom events when you're there live, that's just great because the buzz of a live production is something extra. But so I won a Euro Tour in 2006, and Eurosport, it's a pan-European broadcasting company. They were showing the Euro Tours. Me winning it was a good way for me to get in. So I called them and I got to sit down and do commentary. So that was one. And then after that, someone mentioned me to do the Eurosport. The Eurosport is broadcast a lot on Eurosport. It's like 100 days a year. That's really a lot. Maybe a bit of overkill. So that's how I got into it. And then, of course, being a former World Pool Master champion, more gigs came from Matchroom. And, you know, it's great. I love it. And it's, for me, Jeremy Jones is, you know, he's knowledgeable and very easy to listen to. You mentioning me together with him, that's very nice. Take that as a big compliment. But I think I'm good and I give good information, but sometimes I try to give too much. So, you know, I'll get a complaint or I'll read some criticism, and it's not like I don't know where that is coming from. If I over psychologize or if I'm being too technical, that's the trainer and the coach in me just overdoing it. But that's it's a job. Commentating it's a skill. So it's more difficult than what I thought it to be when I started.
Yeah, the part that I'm trying to get for the anybody who listens to the podcast, you know that I've been working towards getting into commentary a little bit more and more. And what I'm finding now is it's very, very difficult to be able to talk to the top players, the worst players, and the people who just enjoy watching pool but don't really even know how to play. And there's this really hard balance to strike between talking at a deep enough level that you don't basically bore the top players, but you don't talk too high skilled to where the lower tiered players can't understand it or you're kind of alienating them. And all the while you have to put on a production and be entertaining enough to keep the people who are just there to watch pool and maybe not play pool in their spare time. you got to be entertaining enough to keep them around. And that is a very, very difficult balance to strike. And the reason why I say I like you and Jeremy the best is because for my money, I think that you three do a very good job at striking that balance at a pretty high level.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks a lot. The thing that I had, it's funny, actually. I was doing a snooker commentary on Ronnie O'Sullivan, maybe the best ever, at least on the 6x12. And at the same moment, like within a minute, I got a tweet. I got two tweets from two viewers. One said, yeah, you're always favoring Ronnie. You're always talking so positive about Ronnie. And the other person said, you're highly critical of Ronnie. At the same point. So it's a lot about interpretation. And that made me more acceptant of what I do and how I try to do it. Understanding better that, you can't please them all. I just try to do my best. I do corporate trainings now. I started doing it a year ago, and I had feedback forms. I asked for feedback. They needed to fill something in, and it was the same. I was telling some anecdotes, and like 15% of the people said they didn't care for the anecdotes, and I could skip them. And some 15% of the people thought that was the icing on the cake. They liked it. It was all good. And the anecdotes, yeah. That was really cool. So in commentating, it's, try to stay close to yourself.
Yeah, you hope that your personality is good enough to where people enjoy listening to you anyways. And then the commentary just comes along with that. So I think we can take this from there. And I think we can talk about the big elephant in the room now. You are now the Team Europe Moscone Cup captain. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
And, of course, this is the biggest event in the world, and you're kind of getting thrown in at a weird time, right? You're not going to have Euro Tours. You're not going to have the World Pool Masters, the World Cup of Pool, anything like that. You're not going to have all of this evidence available to you so that you can really – of course, there's three players that just automatically qualify via the Euro Tour, but – that's not available this year. It might come down to you just having to pick five players without a large amount of evidence to do so. What do you think that the future of that is going to be like? And of course, do you think that you're at a disadvantage by having to kind of pick a team potentially with no evidence?
At a disadvantage. I don't want to be, we can't foresee the future. The only thing we know now that this whole qualification structure that was set up, it's not there. There are no tournaments. So we only know that it's possible, that it might even be likely that we overgo this structure and limit amount of qualifiers, which I already communicated to a bigger pool of players. And that would mean that we have to choose, Carl and me, based on past experiences and a little bit of form. For example, Gorst, he's well set on the ranking, but were it not the case, still being the world champion, he was very good a couple of months back. So it means we have to go by past results and past performances in matchroom events and outside of the matchroom arena. Is that a disadvantage? I don't think so. I don't think so, because any debutant can be a liability. Anyone that qualifies and is not there because of status in the sport can be a liability, can also be the missing link, like 2 years ago, Tyler Steyer was in London. He was the mystery pick by Johan, and Johan got a lot of stick because of it. But then in the end, they're down 2-0. Steyer is behind against Feyen, wins that match, and then the whole momentum shifted.
Yeah, they went three straight from there.
So it can be an X factor, a debutant, a new one. But for us, for Carl and me, to maybe pick more based on past results and past performances, no, I don't see it as a disadvantage. No.
Yeah. So I guess the broader question, I guess, that would fit into would be the U.S. has, I mean, in the wildest dreams of anybody who's going to pick the Team USA Moscone Cup team, you're basically picking from a pool of like 10 to 15 players. You have Shane, Sky, probably Justin Bergman, and like those three that there's just nobody else that you can pick as long as they're all in the right frame of mind and all that stuff. I mean, those three are the best that the U.S. has to offer, I think. And then you're basically picking two more players from players like Oscar, Tyler, Billy, and you could continue on down the line there, but there's not a ton of players. You could create 4 to 5 to 6 different European teams any given year. And so a lot of the information that you use to pick these players, it's really based off of who's peaking at the right time. And that was Jason Shaw last year. And Jason Shaw, you know, he won the International Open. He won the match before that. I'm blanking on where it was. I think it was an event in Texas. But he'd won the two events going into the Moscone Cup. And then he played very well in the Moscone Cup. So a lot of it is picking the players that are peaking at the right time. We might not have that available to us this year.
Yeah, but in regard to Shaw, he is better than just a player who peaked at the right time. I mean, he's a proven thoroughbred.
Yes, definitely.
That is, and you know, if we get to have more wild cards, it would be unlucky for potentials who could have made it, who had a couple of good tournaments. So it's more likely, of course, that we will go on past performances and past results, like proven winners.
Definitely. And you would hope that I know for a fact that Sky, just having his child and the shutdown and everything, he does not have a pool table at his home, and he hasn't played pool now since basically Vegas for the Diamond. So, you know, there's situations like that you have to take into account as well. Of course, Sky's going to make the team no matter what because he's such a monster on the pool table. But that does eliminate maybe some players from the field if they're not able to play pool at all. So
it's definitely not easy. You know, my high potentials or the usual suspects that I speak to. They have access to a table, but still, for some of them, most of them, it's very difficult to have the same work ethics now as they would have in normal circumstances. So they're keeping in shape, but it's not like they're at 100%. They're not firing on all cylinders. So as we get closer to the pool market reopening, but we don't know when, we don't know exactly how, all good pool players will get themselves ready real quick, because maybe through this period they'll have learned that rest and maybe not spending so much time for a while can do a lot of good to your game. Because in general, I think players are used a lot, maybe too much, on on overdoing the work. I mean, you need to work hard to get there, but result is talent, preparation, and rest. So who knows? You know, we all try to get better out of this crisis period, smarter, adding maybe a couple of tricks to our game. But a lot of that is in the head.
Definitely. So Team Europe, going into 2018, Team Europe wins 8 straight years. And basically, I guess 10 of the last 11 years. The U.S. has now won 2 straight years. What is going to be the most important thing for you to do as the coach to get the win column back for Team Europe?
I think I'm convinced that the team needs to be a team. So without making any judgment on previous years, it's obvious that the skill is there, the level is there, the heart is there. I think a lot of it is about bonding as a team. A lot of it is about communication. Also, so communication about, away from the table, just being open and transparent and exposing yourself to the group, but also a lot about what happens at the table. And especially in doubles play, we haven't been doing well, Europe. We need to up our game there. And I think a lot of is in agreeing beforehand how you are going to act together at the table. So I think I did pick up some signs in previous years where I saw that players, that it wasn't clear enough who played the push out, whether the player liked to get input from his partner or not. Do you interfere with shot selection? Do you step back? And this works different for every player. And also being used to, you know, when things are not going your way, to not panic and to express any negativity that you have and to throw everything out in the open, basically.
Yeah, and it's it is kind of the flip-flop where, historically speaking, the U.S. would always dominate the singles and Team Europe would always, you know, make up for it in the Scotch doubles. So it is interesting that the dynamic has flipped from that to, I guess, the U.S. now doing well in the Scotch doubles. Do you think that is maybe because the Team U.S. has had that influence from Johan to where they've gotten closer as a team, and it's basically the same team every year, right? So they're able to really build that chemistry like Europe doesn't really have the chance to?
That's definitely my conviction. Johan brought structure and process, and for some of them or all of them, he had to install some new routines, like a work ethic and the sharing of knowledge, the sharing of insecurities, hanging out together, getting to know each other. That's definitely a big thing. Work ethic and gelling. So I think winning comes. Some people ask me, oh, I never make 100 in straight pool, or I never win a tournament, I always finish, I lose the semifinal. I think a player will win if he thinks it's time to win, when he feels he deserves to win. So, and if you work hard, this belief grows automatically. If you do the work, you will feel like you earn it. So when things get ugly or rough, or when you're under pressure, instead of thinking about the pressure, you will just have this strong belief from within and conviction that it's your time to take it. And of course, there's a lot of luck involved in the game, a lot of variance, and maybe you did all you could do, but you just got unlucky. But if you keep knocking the door, it will open. And now, so last year, the USA won second time in a row. They came with a stronger belief in what they were doing, that it was right. And they had the momentum. So last year was an easier win for them than the year before. And that's good, because now we have a good fight. You know, the players from Europe are pumped up to get their mojo back and to get the wind in their own sails again. But it doesn't come automatically. So there's what you do with your cue and the balls and the shot in front of you. But there's also the four other guys in the team and the two coaches being Carl and me. And that over 4 days, that's a lot of psychology and dynamics that come into play. And Johan has managed to manage it well.
Yeah, definitely. So that is going to be, I would assume that is going to be the first matter of business that you attend to as the coach then, is to reinstilling that I guess that seriousness and that desire and that want to with Team Europe to really get them back to the winning ways.
Yes, but let it be said that with all the eagerness that I feel and all the eagerness that European players have to make it to the team and to get in action, we're at a standstill at the moment. So even though I am communicating to some players and I've done a couple of trainings online, it's not the workload for me and for other players and as a group together as I would like it to be. So, you know, I'm there, I'm with it, but it's not, it hasn't kicked off like it could have or would have had we not had this COVID-19.
Definitely. It puts it in a weird kind of starting spot with how to really get
acting. Kinda.
So, taking this from there, without giving away any of your thought process, maybe I should say, what is the kind of team that you are looking to fill out then for Europe? Are you looking for people with more proven experience as far as been there, done that, previous champions, previous MVPs, anything like that? Or are you looking for more the next revolution to see the next generation of players to, you know, really give them a chance to get out on the big stage and show what they have to show?
Well, it's you know, it's unlikely that that we'll have a surprise player get in the team because there are no tournaments. They don't get a chance to show themselves, to convince us. But Gorst, being the reigning world champion, you know, it's more than likely that he will be on a team. But I wouldn't count on any surprises to make it. You know, we have a bunch of talented players. You know, I don't know how many tournaments we will have for people to make it through the qualifying structure. I don't know how many wildcards I will have, which is really, it's a shitstorm, and I wouldn't want it to be like that. But it's likely we will see usual suspects in the team.
With great power comes great responsibility, and you might end up having 5 wild cards. It's not impossible to have that.
No comment. Yeah, I mean, I've already communicated to a bigger pool of players that we won't go with 2 wild cards. It'll be more, since the qualification structure doesn't make for a good process to judge on performance. We'll see. We'll have to wait. You know, and Emily Fraser and Matchroom, they're trying to do their best. And we can assume things, but we're still a bit in the dark, I fear.
Yeah, a lot of speculation, which is one, it's very fun. It creates content, right? I mean, the fact that we can talk about these things and speculate what we think should happen, what we think should happen, what we think will happen, stuff like that. It creates fun, interesting content.
Well, that's good. That's good for you, but I don't find it enjoyable.
Yeah, I mean, it's the pool world, maybe I should say.
Yeah. But regardless which 5 will make it on the team, success will depend not on the name, but on the person's ability to make it work with the 5 players that are out there.
Yeah, and you have an embarrassment of riches in Europe with, I mean, there are just so many top players that you could choose from. It's an embarrassment of riches, but it really gives you something to think about.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just looking forward to do the work with the players and go out there. And when we get out there in the arena, take back the cup, because 2 years is enough.
And I've already had my flights booked. I already have my tickets booked. I will be there, and I am really, really looking forward to this. It's after being basically locked up for the last 4 months. I hope that I am able to get there and, you know, just really spend another week watching some really awesome pool. If you've never been to the Moscone Cup, you're just missing out on everything. It is the best.
Yeah, I was in 2 years ago. I commentated for the first time in it was in Ali Pali. And before, they had this DJ playing songs and maybe some 2,500 people singing along. And I was on the floor getting ready to do like an intro with Andy Goldstein. And I have this earpiece, but the sound wasn't on yet. And Andy was standing next to me and I couldn't hear what he was saying. So since then, if people ask me for my nicest like memories in pool, this is definitely in the top three. But now being the captain is going to be even better.
Yeah, I agree. And I was in Ali Pally for that as well. That was the first Moscone Cup that I had ever attended. And I told myself, by hook or by crook, I will not miss another one of these. So that was, man, that was wild. The Europeans, they really, really know how to put on a great event.
Yeah, it was awesome. So you're hooked.
I am hooked, yes. Ali Pally did it for me. Watching the U.S. take it back in Ali Pally with all the European fans. I mean, there was – so I was sitting basically two seats behind the players, and there was about 25 of us, I would say, that were all in our little section. And of the 2,500 fans, there was about 20 in our section, which is the U.S. section. And besides that, there was probably another maybe 50 people throughout the entire arena that was Americans. The rest of the 2,500 were all Europeans. So being able to just kind of look out and be, yeah, we won it this year. That was fun.
Nate, cherish that memory.
I do.
Cherish it.
Yeah, I do. It was an absolute blast. And I got a feeling you're going to tell me that it's going to last. That's going to be the last time I get to see an American win on European soil.
Well, last time, next time the two continents are up against each other, or actually the country versus the continent, next Moscone Cup in London, we'll do everything in our might to make it different. And even having lost twice in a row, I don't know what the bookies will say. The market decides who's favorite. And then again, it's all on paper. You need to do it at the table.
Absolutely.
Well, when action kicks off, we'll be ready.
And I will be in the stands, probably with a Bailey's and coffee, ready to cheer on as loud as I possibly can.
Okay, good. Sounds good.
I think that's probably a pretty good place to leave it. Alex, I thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, you're welcome. It was fun. And I'll see you in London.
I'll see you in London. It's going to be a blast. Thank you again one more time for commentating with me with Josh and Tony as well. It was a pleasure to get to chat with you. It's a pleasure to get to meet you a little bit more by doing this podcast. And you gained a fan in the U.S., even if I'm going to be cheering for U.S. anyways.
All right, cool. Take care, Nate.
Yep. Thanks, Alex.